Hello. Welcome to this week's edition of the Africa Climate Conversations podcast. I'm your host, Sophie Mbogwa. So last week, Peter told us of different methods communities use to predict how the weather patterns will change. So as I promised, this week, Professor Muthoni Masindi, a Kenyan-born computer scientist working in South Africa, who created a mobile app, information technology and indigenous knowledge, Itiki, alerting farmers on drought via SMS, tells us why documenting this indigenous knowledge is critical in dealing with climate change for the African communities.
So thank you so much, Professor Masindi, for finding time to join us.
It's my pleasure.
So before we dig in into documenting indigenous knowledge, I would want you to first introduce yourself and just tell us a little bit, who is Professor Masindi?
Thank you, Sophie. I am a village girl born and bred in Kenya, in Mbere, in eastern part of Kenya. Educated there, went to the University of Nairobi, did computer science, did my master's in Europe, and did my PhD in South Africa. So computer science is my cup of tea. I dream it, I live it. And that's how I decided, when I thought I had done enough, I decided to use it to help people in Mbere to predict droughts. So I currently live in South Africa. After my PhD, I stayed on. But everything I do, I first think about home. The solution starts home.
Oh, absolutely.
And then I expand it elsewhere. Yes, Sophie.
Okay. Last week, we had a very good conversation with Peter, and he was telling us about different indigenous natural way of predicting how the weather will be, how the seasons will be. We left at documenting indigenous knowledge. What do you think, how important is it, documenting indigenous knowledge?
It's absolutely important. And for me, it's a matter of urgency, because we've lost so much of this knowledge. With my estimation, I think we've lost up to 50% of the knowledge. First, because the young people, when they go to school and go to cities, they do not see the value of the knowledge. So the parents are not able to pass it on to them. So like, I remember my grandma passed away about 6 months ago. She had so much rich knowledge, and I don't think we captured everything we would have captured from her. So it's very urgent that we document it now. And there are many ways of documenting it. So within the Tiki project, that's one of our objectives. So we can create a database, a live database, where you keep updating as new observations are done. And then you can ensure the local people continue to own it. I don't advocate where scientists come and take the knowledge and go back to the city. The village, the community people must always own it. So we must do it such that they continue to own it, because they're the ones who will continue updating it. So for us, we use that bottom approach. So the update, it's like we are keeping it for them. We are helping them to keep, to store it, but they should be the one keeping it. But Sophia, I just need to mention, indigenous knowledge is tricky to document. Because we don't use numbers. You see, in the scientific one, we say it will be 10 degrees, it will be 3 degrees. So it's easier to store numbers. But the indigenous knowledge is holistic. It's a story. It's visual. So it requires more complicated science. So in our case, what we've done, like I mentioned, being a computer scientist, I have acquired tools and knowledge that is capable to do that. So we are using artificial neural networks, the whole field of artificial intelligence. And then if you, for example, one of the examples Peter was giving you, where they're saying the weather is like this, now you need to spray your pigeon piss. That's a story that you cannot convert into numbers. So we use tools we call quasi cognitive maps. So they are able to store the knowledge in the computers, but still retain the richness of that indigenous knowledge. So that's what we're doing. We've been doing it for almost since 2013. but we applied more vigor to the project the last 3 years. Okay. And we have a huge database for Mbeere, which we would want to expand to other communities.
Before we get into the depth of how you do it, why should we document it? Because then we've modernized, we've equipment, scientific equipments that we can actually use to observe that is quicker, you know, than actually having a whole story and having, you know, going into the villages and, you know, listening to people, what they say. Why is it important? Why should we still keep this very old way of doing things when probably societies have evolved and societies have moved? Why is it important to still keep observing and documenting this knowledge?
Sorry, I'm laughing because I think for a number of years, the scientists, especially the scientists in the climate discipline, overlooked that knowledge. But I can assure you now the world has really discovered the mistake. First, the indigenous knowledge is something that the local people relate with. And it's actually a tool for adaptation. If I give you an example, the local people in Mbeere used to grow sorghum a lot.
Yeah.
And then this civilization came, they started planting maize and beans.
Mm-hmm.
And they listened to the scientists without remembering in their roots that millet grew better in their soils.
Yeah.
And required less rain. Mm-hmm. So they went to beans, they started starving. So indigenous knowledge, first and foremost, is more accurate. We, from our research over almost 10 years now, in the local scale, when I say local scale, I mean within my village or my mom's village of where you are. If you look through the window, we have a better judgment of your weather than what Kenya Met is seeing from the country level. So from a local point of view, it's almost 100% accurate. And within a span of up to 6 months, because in our system we use both indigenous and scientific, indigenous knowledge is always superior.
Because
it's highly localized. It's the tree outside my gate. It's the bird making noise near me. So it's highly accurate. And we need to retain this. However, we should not also, we can't say science is not correct. Both of them are exactly useful, but we use them together to produce a superior adaptation, prediction, whatever tool we want.
Yeah.
But local knowledge is the tool for survival. It's no doubt about that. It's proven. We are just forgotten about it.
Okay. And also that means in terms of ownership, because one of the things in the years that I've been doing environmental reporting and climate change, I've learned and I've seen that when communities own something, when they feel like they participated, it becomes more trustworthy. It becomes something that they actually own and follow. Is it the same case when it comes to issues of indigenous knowledge?
It's 100% the case, Sophie. So for example, earlier on, you're giving an example where Kenya Met, they say the probability of rainfall is 20%. Do you know the local people use the same? But the moment you tell them in the scientific language, they don't understand. But you tell them in the language they have always known. I wish we could use our own local language. You know, it might rain. If you just translate that to Kikuyu or to my language, it might rain.
Yeah.
My mother understands that. But if you come tell them, there will be near normal rain. Oh, my goodness. They have no idea what that is. So the ownership, you're right, is so core. So they will use it and they will trust it.
And probably that also goes into the issues, the whole issues of dealing with climate change. As in, because when I speak to my grandmother, the understanding is that things have always changed. The weather always changed. And even when we were speaking to Peter, they understood the change in knowledge. And probably maybe we need to go back a little bit and have a very informal kind of explanation of what indigenous knowledge is. Because someone probably could be listening to us and failing to understand what do these two people mean.
Yeah, in fact, in the science world, when you see indigenous, sometimes people might assume we are talking about a backward thing, like you said. Indigenous could also mean local to me, what I've used over the years. So over the years, my mother, your mom, the village people, the small-scale farmers, have passed on some knowledge. I'll give you one example. Over the years, they knew that the rains, the April, May rain, March, April, May rains in eastern Kenya, they would start around 15th of March.
Yeah.
That's knowledge they knew, even without the Kenya Met. And they knew that the wind will start blowing from south towards the north. And then a particular tree, like the example Peter was giving you, will start flowering. And they will also know that the ants, you know, the little ants will start moving on a straight line. And that frogs will be hand croaking knee in the nearby water body. All these things is what we're referring to indigenous knowledge. And like I said, you can call it indigenous environmental knowledge, local knowledge. So there are those things that we've observed, we've seen, we've smelled, and our parents passed it on to them. We passed on to our children from generation to generation. And you know, Sophie, is actually, from my studies, it's actually science in itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because when you see an insect precipitating a particular behavior, it's reacting to something like humidity, it's reacting to something like temperature. So it's highly scientific, just as we don't call it science. So it's not a myth. It's indigenous knowledge we can actually account for.
Fantastic. Now, you said indigenous knowledge is a story. How do you package this knowledge into a drought predicting tool?
So what we've done, we started off with mapping the story. In other words, we noticed that these patterns fall into particular seasons. So we drew the pattern for Kenya. We have four seasons. We have the rain season that happens around March. Then we have the dry spell where in July, August is included. Then we have another rain season. And then we documented the story such that when the wind starts blowing in March, when the cows start coming home early March, jumping up and down, when the particular birds are seen settling on trees in March, all that information relates to the onset of the March rainfall. So we documented that in the system.
Okay.
And then, for example, right now we are busy observing the indicators that precede the October rainfall. And that's why when we started talking, I said, oh my God, I've been informed that it's drizzling in September. The temperatures are very low. The birds that are usually seen are not there anymore. The cows look down. So that already is forming a particular direction of the story. That the rains could easily come so much later than usual.
Yeah.
They could come with thunder, or they could come with huge showers and then stop suddenly. So with all that story, once we document, we create in a computer database, which now, as we observe this, we have wireless sensors. Peter has some of them, and we also have access to data from weather stations by other companies in Kenya. So when the farmers are saying, "Oof, it's very cold today," on the other hand, we have a sensor saying it's 5 degrees. When they say, "Oh, now it's like you said, the sun will start coming out," then we have weather station telling us it's gone 15 degrees. So at the end of the day, then we combine those two, and the product is much superior than just using one source in isolation from the other.
And how does this information get to communities?
Okay, so to start with, we have a mobile app, a Tiki mobile app, which we have given to small-scale farmers who we call, they are like our salespeople, but we don't see them as such. So we each one of them, at the moment in Kenya, we have 9 of them.
Okay.
We've given them this phone, so they document in real time what is going on. And each one of them is assigned a location so that we avoid overlap and we ensure coverage. So each one of them record, then when they see it raining, when they see the cows coming back home jumping, when they see the ant moving in a straight line, or they see the white frog, that information comes to the database or immediately. And like I said before, since we have structured the story, so we wait for a threshold. So we know that if it's around July, let's work with September, since we're in September.
Yeah.
If we're in September and the temperatures are constantly at a lower, at the ranges of below 20, and we notice that a number of cows look down, and we notice that the recording is saying the particular tree is delaying in flowering. I'll give one example. A particular mango tree, like the mango trees that thrive a lot in a dry area, the one that produce small mangoes.
Okay.
If many of those have completely flowered, it's an indication, because you already know the story. If that happens, it's actually a sign it's going to be a drought. I don't know how nature works, but it's the opposite. The mango trees that tend to have bigger fruits, if they are the ones who have flowered more, it's a sign that there will be more rain. It kind of nature prepares its own aspect, because the bigger mango requires more rainfall. So if there will be no rain, it doesn't bother flowering. We want to put it that way. So with all those triggers, and when I say threshold, if it's only one ambassador who noticed it, that's not enough for a prediction. So in the when the threshold hits, the prediction happens. That when I say prediction, we have artificial neural network models. Artificial neural network models, we train them to use the story you've given it, and then it will tell you what is going to happen. And it does so, it also reports to us what is the accuracy. So it will say, oh, it's here is a prediction. The oncoming rains will be less than what the farmers are used to. And since we've learned from the farmers, if that's the case, what should we tell them? We'll tell them, oh, people need to plant within 1 week of September, of October. Otherwise, you won't harvest anything. And when you do plant, do not plant maize. Some of them won't. A few of them will think it's a joke. So don't plant maize, just plant millet only. And so that information is translated into the Kimbere language. And an SMS is generated automatically. And each of our farmers, the moment we have slightly over 10,000 in the database, each of the farmers will get, they say, hello, Tiki calling. The forecast says 1, 2, 3, and you need to, do 3, 4, 5. And then with the ambassadors, not like salespeople, they can do follow up, because some people will ask questions. Are you serious? Is this coming from Itiki? But in most of the cases, actually, they are not surprised, because that's the very information they are seeing. That's the very information they provided, So that's how it works. The only difference in the other countries then is we use different, like in South Africa, we are working with the Zulu people. So we use the Zulu language for them.
And in terms of the challenges that you've actually faced, what would you say the challenges has been?
Okay, most of the challenges I would say is based on our approach, because it's a bottom up. So scaling up can be very slow. So for instance, there's a big difference between the people living in Bere South and people living in Bere North. Even a little one here and there, the differences start emerging. And also the kind of indicators they use in the Bere North is different from the one used Bere South. So for us to upscale to Bere North, when we need to recruit a whole new team, we need to set up a whole new set of weather stations. But for me, it's a challenge, but yet that's where the success is. Because we don't want to send focus that are meant for Bere South to people of Bere North, because it will not make sense to them. So that would be. The second one, I think it's our people, it's taking long for people to remember, because we kind of brainwashed them.
Yeah.
If Mudhoni has gone to school, in fact, sometimes when I go to visit, I sit in the background because they're like, oh, she's prof. Oh, she's gone to South Africa. She's gone to Europe. So then they think I'm the one who knows. And it's not the case. Yeah. So it takes time to actually tell them, this is your information. This is what is good for you. But somehow it takes time. But when it does work, it's the best thing that happens to us. So it's a painful, slow process to reverse what has been damaged. You know, the what they watch on the TV, they think is more valuable. Mm. If my mother hears it's raining in Nairobi because the daughter has said so, then she thinks that the gospel truth. They forget that what is local to them, what they knew in the beginning, they need to go back to their roots.
Yeah,
and make it what they used to. Yeah, so those would be the challenges. But of course, Sophia, I would be responsible if I forgot to mention that climate change is really frustrating people.
Yeah, yeah.
Because as much as we are predicting, we are not God, so we can't give back the rain. So right now they are frustrated. It means that it won't rain again. But yet, for us, apart from giving the bad news, we really can't. And do the bad news. To me, sometimes it hurts, but it's the nature. What can we do?
And to what extent, speaking of climate change, has the whole now issues of climate change affected the indigenous knowledge and that certainty of this knowledge?
Among the factors that has eroded indigenous knowledge, top on the list is climate change.
Mm.
Because like I was saying initially, one of the most reliable local indicator for rain was season patterns.
Mm.
That has completely been distorted. So as much as a new mid-March it will rain, sometimes this has gone on until, there's a time I remember it didn't rain until May and everyone was disoriented, everything had gone to hopelessness. So it's massive. And of course, things like the fact that they used to use water bodies to determine some of these indicators. So they are not there.
Mm.
And then they used to use bigger trees. They knew this tree will flower, but those trees are not there anymore. So it's completely messed everything for the indigenous knowledge people.
How do we bring together modernization, climate change, and also have people find their own local way of dealing with the whole climate issues? How do we get there? How do we get back to basics?
It's a complex way. But like I said, somebody needs to start the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a strong advocate of being... going back to the roots. In fact, that's my latest slogan. Let's go back to our roots and use the bottom-up approach. But you see, that becomes a very huge project, because if my mom is buying a bar of soap from the shop, I think it's only the manufacturer of that soap who can help us, because at least give the information in a way that they can understand. If the local government, the county government can play a role using different sectors. For example, me, I think the agricultural sector can play a very critical role. Have a dialogue with the farmers, have sessions, let them know that the local knowledge is equally important. When you buy your fertilizers from the shops, because sometimes it's consumer way of just pushing products to people, it's what is damaging us. When you buy one bag of fertilizer, you need it.
Yeah.
But then don't forget that the manure, like I remember for us when you grew up, we could, because my parents and grandparents and cattle, most of it we use the manure, and that is more sustainable. But just because someone want to do to see the main mushrooming overnight without knowing that it will mushroom overnight today, Here, 3 years from now, you'll have nothing to, you know, there's no sustainability.
Mm.
So it's a huge dialogue, but it's complex. Everyone just needs to come on board and talk about. The church need to be involved.
Mm.
The schools need to be involved. Government need to be involved. All of us need to be involved. You and I alone may not win the battle.
Absolutely. And if, now, for example, for Itiki, for your case, how long did it take you before now to get this kind of, to get these narratives, and to even get to the point where now you have a story that you can feed in to the computer system
In the beginning, it took me 3 years. That's mm-hmm. quite long.
Yeah.
You know, documenting slowly by slowly.
Mm.
And also we wanted to, since we wanted a tool that can be upscaled to other places. Yeah. So we also took time to document knowledge from other communities to compare. Mm. And that's why we're able to tell, wherever you go in this world, you can classify indigenous knowledge into 5 categories. With that in mind, then we're able to design a system that once it worked for Mbere people, we could easily cross over to Mozambique and just change the parameters and the indicators there and then train the system afresh. Mm. So that's why it took 3 years.
Okay.
But even after taking 3 years to work with the people, to for them start seeing the value, it's been 9 years later.
Wow.
So it's that long. Yes.
Yeah, that's one long time.
Definitely so, yes.
I'm wondering what role does the policy play in terms of us going back to basic, and how vital are they?
It's massive. You know, I stand by saying that when we use indigenous knowledge, we should not take it from the people and co-publish papers with it without them.
Mm.
So that policy of protecting the indigenous people and the indigenous knowledge for me is critical.
Mm-hmm.
The IP, the intellectual property of that knowledge, should always be with the people.
Mm-hmm.
But for that to happen, we must register it. And then the government also needs to make it like a policy to support the farmers in documenting this knowledge, because it costs money.
Yeah.
But you see, if let me give an example of Embu County, because there's a lot of farming happening in Embu. If the farmers do not produce the yield they anticipated, it means that the county government then will have to use the money that was meant for development to support, to give food relief to those farmers.
Mm.
Yet they could have invested in systems that can alert the farmers, because sometimes you will see 2 different farmers. Maybe if you draw in the village, you'll notice.
Yeah.
5 different farmers, 3 harvest, 2 do not.
Yeah, sure.
Because of a simple wrong decision.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think the policies need to be placed to support that and ensure that this thing of climate change is incorporated into these policies. It's absolutely. In fact, to me, without them, we may not go far.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And thank you so much. But your final word.
Oh, my final word.
Yes.
I would like to say we must just embrace our indigenous knowledge.
Mm.
It's not just for climate change, it's for everything.
Mm.
Because we've embraced so much of the knowledge coming from wherever without putting the context that works for us. So let's embrace it. Anytime I just think indigenous knowledge is sustainable, it's the future, it's the one that will make our people be able to adapt to climate change. Sophie.
You said it so right. Well, thank you so much, Professor Masinde.
Sophie, thanks.
All right.
That was Professor Masinde on documenting indigenous knowledge. Are you working with communities and helping them adapt to climate change? Well, get in touch with us through info@africaclimateconversations.com or reach us through Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. This podcast and many others are available on all podcast channels you access, you other podcasts from, or on our website, africaclimateconversations.com. Until next week, kwaheri. Have yourself a productive and safe week ahead.